All right, China, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan. The largest untapped reserves of oil and natural gas in the world are right here. We couldn't build a pipeline out through Russia because the Russians knew that if they had the pipeline, they could control it and tax it. They could threaten American control and they could move south to control all of this. And we're going to see how that happens. And what's been on the table, as most of you, I would hope by now know, has been a long-planned pipeline to be headed by Unocal, built by Halliburton, the feasibility studies done by Enron, which I'll be writing about in an upcoming issue, to be built from here straight down to the Pakistani coast. Now, the crying demand for oil now, and I'm going to scare you about oil in just a minute, is in China, the Far East, which has an exploding economy needing energy. Oil is not just for driving cars, folks. Most power plants burn on natural gas that generate electricity, especially in China. Fertilizers come from ammonia, which comes from natural gas, which is the Siamese twin of oil. And pesticides come from petroleum products. 90% of the plastics in the world, you are sitting on oil tonight, come from oil. It is ammonia and petroleum-based pesticides, the fertilizers and the pesticides, that allow 1 acre of land that normally produces 30 bushels of corn to produce 135 bushels of corn. World population is exploding. The demand for oil in the Far East, in China and Japan, and in the developing nations is huge. The U.S. can control it directly by the pipeline south, and we're going to see that in a second. The plan is to build a pipeline and to transport it around to China and Japan. And, of course, to take whatever we need for U.S. use along the way. Now, let's look at some quotes from what Brzezinski had to say in 1997. Pay close attention. Bear in mind, every word of this was written 4 years before the World Trade Center. The last decade of the 20th century has witnessed a tectonic shift in world affairs. For the first time ever, a non-Eurasian power has emerged, not only as a key arbiter of Eurasian power relations, but also as the world's paramount power. The defeat and collapse of the Soviet Union was the final step in the rapid ascendance of a Western Hemisphere power, the United States, as the sole and indeed the first truly global superpower. That's in the preface. But in the meantime, it is imperative that no Eurasian challenger emerges capable of dominating Eurasia and thus of also challenging America. The formulation of a comprehensive and integrated Eurasian geostrategy is therefore the purpose of this book. Listen to this very carefully now. The attitude of the American public, this is from page 24, toward the external projection of American power has been much more ambivalent. The public supported America's engagement in World War II largely because of the shock effect of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. It gets a lot worse. For America, the chief geopolitical prize is Eurasia. Now, a non-Eurasian power is preeminent in Eurasia, and America's global primacy is directly dependent on how long and how effectively its preponderance on the Eurasian continent is sustained. Everything depends upon controlling Eurasia. America's withdrawal from the world, or because of the sudden emergence of a successful rival, would produce massive international instability. Maybe we would call that democracy. It would prompt global anarchy. Everybody who thinks a little anarchy would be a good thing, raise your hand. In that context, you're going to love this, how America manages Eurasia. Do we manage countries? Is that our job? Land of the free and the home of the brave? Manages Eurasia is critical. Eurasia is the globe's largest continent and is geopolitically axial. A power that dominates Eurasia would control two of the world's three most advanced and economically productive regions. A mere glance at the map also suggests that control over Eurasia would almost automatically entail Africa's subordination, rendering the Western Hemisphere and Oceania, that's Australia for the non-academics, geopolitically peripheral to the world's central continent. Listen closely. About 75% of the world's people live in Eurasia, and most of the world's physical wealth is there as well, both in its enterprises and underneath its soil. Eurasia accounts for 60% of the world's GNP and about 3/4 of the world's known energy resources. Now, here's a quote that this has kind of become a tradition as I do this. We did it for a joke in Portland, but it's really caught on, and so I'm getting to like this. So there are two quotes here that I absolutely have to read with a German accent. I was raised on the war movies, you know, with the SS officers and all that, you know, so this just has to happen that way. All right, this is from page 35. It is also a fact that America is too democratic at home to be autocratic abroad. This limits the use of America's power, especially its capacity for military intimidation. Never before has a populist democracy attained international supremacy. But the pursuit of power is not a goal that commands popular passion, except in conditions of a sudden threat or challenge to the public sense of domestic well-being. The economic self-denial that is the defense spending and the human sacrifice, I love that human sacrifice, casualties even among professional soldiers required in the effort are uncongenial to democratic instincts. Democracy is inimical to imperial mobilization. One lesson I learned a long time ago, what the gods would destroy, they would first make ludicrous. We must learn to laugh at these bastards in their faces sometimes. Two basic steps are thus required. First, to identify the geostrategically dynamic Eurasian states that have the power to cause a potentially important shift in the international distribution of power, and to decipher the central external goals of their respective political elites and the likely consequences of their seeking to attain them. Second, to formulate specific U.S. policies to offset, co-opt, and or control the above. To put it, I gotta try, I haven't done this yet. I should maybe do this one in a British accent. This just seems to fit better. To put it in a terminology that harkens back to the more brutal age of ancient empires, the three grand imperatives of imperial geostrategy are to prevent collusion and maintain security dependence among the vassals, to keep tributaries pliant, and to keep the barbarians from coming together. Henceforth, the United States may have to determine how to cope with regional coalitions that seek to push America out of Eurasia, thereby threatening America's status as a global power. Uzbekistan, remember Uzbekistan? Uzbekistan, nationally the most vital and the most populous of the Central Asian states, represents the major obstacle to any renewed Russian control over the region. Its independence is critical to the survival of the other Central Asian states and is the least vulnerable to Russian pressures. Referring to an area he calls the Eurasian Balkans. Okay, referring to an area he calls the Eurasian Balkans and a 1997 map in which he has circled the exact location of the current conflict. He made that map 4 years ago, ladies and gentlemen. Where are we fighting now? Okay, and that current conflict, describing it as the central region of pending conflict for world dominance, Brzezinski writes, moreover, they, the Central Asian republics, are of importance from the standpoint of security and historical ambitions to at least three of their most immediate and more powerful neighbors, namely Russia, Turkey, and Iran, with China also signaling an increasing political interest in the region. But the Eurasian Balkans are infinitely more important as a potential economic prize. An enormous concentration of natural gas and oil reserves is located in the region in addition to important minerals, including gold. Now, there is an old saying that I have learned from the intelligence community. God equals gold, oil, and drugs. In Afghanistan, we have all three. Where was the first place we sent military troops after September 11th? Uzbekistan. I got news for you. We were already there. Had been for some years. Training, preparing. Now listen to this very closely before I start to really scare the shit out of you. I'm saying the S word a lot. Is that okay? Anybody mind? You've heard it before. We're all activists, right? All right. The world's energy consumption is bound to vastly increase over the next two or three decades. Estimates by the U.S. Department of Energy anticipate that world demand will rise by more than 50% between 1993 and 2015, with the most significant increase in consumption occurring in the Far East. The momentum of Asia's economic development is already generating massive pressures for the exploration and exploitation of new sources of energy. And the Central Asian region and the Caspian Sea basin are known to contain reserves of natural gas and oil that dwarf those of Kuwait, the Gulf of Mexico, or the North Sea. Last estimate, $5 trillion worth. Uzbekistan is, in fact, the prime candidate for regional leadership in Central Asia. Once pipelines to the area have been developed, 1997, Turkmenistan's truly vast natural gas reserves augur a prosperous future for the country's people. In fact, he says on 133, an Islamic revival already abetted from the outside, not only by Iran, but also by Saudi Arabia, is likely to become the mobilizing impulse for the increasingly pervasive new nationalisms determined to oppose any reintegration under Russian, hence infidel, control. Now, let me tell you a secret. The United States has created Islamic terrorists and Islamic fundamentalism in the purest sense, not because these people knew they were being manipulated. This is a science they engage in. But the reason we have created all of these groups was to keep Russia from getting anywhere near the oil in the Middle East and in Central Asia. A long-term plan. There's a whole book about it. There's heavy documents about it, but that's the context. For Pakistan, the primary interest is to gain geostrategic depth through political influence in Afghanistan and to deny Iran the exercise of such influence in Afghanistan and Tajikistan and to benefit eventually from any pipeline construction linking Central Asia with the Arabian Sea. Turkmenistan has been actively exploring the construction of a new pipeline through Afghanistan and Pakistan to the Arabian Sea, 1997. It follows that America's primary interest is to help ensure that no single power comes to control this geopolitical space and that the global community has unhindered financial and economic access to it. The global financial community is us. Okay, or the New World Order, globalization. There it is. China's growing economic presence in the region and its political stake in the area's independence are also congruent with America's interests. China's a partner in this, regardless of what the right-wing bozos who can't find any fault in America want to think. China is totally behind this because they can't build a 5,000-mile pipeline. Halliburton can. America is now the only global superpower, and Eurasia is the globe's central arena. Hence, what happens to the distribution of power on the Eurasian continent will be of decisive importance to America's global primacy and to America's historical legacy. I don't know how you want to be remembered. Without sustained and directed involvement, before long, the forces of global disorder, democracy, could come to dominate the world scene, and the possibility of such a fragmentation is inherent in the geopolitical tensions, not only of today's Eurasia, but of the world more generally. With warning signs across on the horizon across Europe and Asia, any successful American policy must focus on Eurasia as a whole and be guided by a geostrategic design. Now we're getting to the end of the book. And he says this puts a premium on maneuver and manipulation in order to prevent a hostile coalition that could eventually seek to challenge America's primacy. The most immediate task is to make certain that no state or combination of states gains the capacity to expel the U.S. from Eurasia or even to diminish significantly its decisive arbitration role. Clearly, he saw Russia as the prime contender. And let me tell you how long this war was planned. During the decade of the 1990s, thanks to Al Gore, Victor Chernomyrdin, the Harvard Endowment, Goldman Sachs, the U.S. Treasury, the World Bank, and the IMF, under a very precisely orchestrated plan, Harvard and Goldman Sachs had the exclusive contract to teach the Russians how to become capitalists. And we looted, the United States looted $300 billion out of the Russian economy over that 10-year period. When the Soviet Union ceased to exist, the population of Russia, that was one of the republics, was about 164, 65 million people. When I was in Russia a year ago, the population was 145 million people. The life expectancy of the average male in Russia is 48 years. There were stories documented in Moldavia and outlying areas outlying of Russia that people were selling flesh from human cadavers as fresh meat because there was no food. So that when the United States made the move into Central Asia, Vladimir Putin had no choice but to do exactly what George Bush wanted him to. That's how far in advance they planned.